Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Chances are, if you are a dedicated WAMC listener, Frank DeFord is a part of your morning routine. The legendary sports writer has delivered more than 1,600 commentaries for Morning Edition over the past 36 years. I've always found his wry and incisive observations a refreshing antidote in an age of shouty sports talk defined by hot takes. An Emmy and Peabody winner, DeFord has written some 18 books and serves as senior contributing writer at Sports Illustrated, where he first appeared in 1962. He's also a correspondent for Real Sports on HBO. This Saturday, DeFord will sign copies of his new book, I'd Know That Voice Anywhere, My Favorite NPR Commentaries, at Sweet Pea in Stone Ridge, New York. And it's my pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable. Thanks for being here.
Ian, nice to be with you.
So the title of your book is I'd Know That Voice Anywhere. Are you recognized by voice a lot?
It's amazing because, especially because I never started, in radio. I was always a writer. And I was amazed when I found out that people literally knew me who had no idea what I looked like, but would hear me. And a culmination of that was when I hate to drop names here, Ian, but if you'll forgive me, my wife and I were at the White House for a reception that the Clintons were giving for sports heroes. And when I introduced myself to Mrs. Clinton, she said, I'd know that voice anywhere, Frank. You wake me up every Wednesday morning. So I've got the presumptive Democratic nominee who recognizes my voice.
Did that interaction make you a bigger fan of hers? I mean, we don't have to get too much into politics.
It certainly impressed me that the First Lady knew me by my voice. I don't think I could be immodest when it comes to that. My vanity rose.
That can have a downside, though, too, if someone disagrees with what you said that week, right?
Well, the fact of the matter is that when you're a commentator, you expect people to disagree with you. As a matter of fact, if they don't disagree with you, you're not doing a very good job. Now, that doesn't mean you want everybody to disagree with you. But when you take sides, and maybe that's especially true in sport. I mean, the whole fun of sport is my team's better than your team. This guy's better than that guy. That goes with the territory. You're a commentator. People are going to disagree with you.
Do you try to be provocative, or does it just happen?
No, I don't try to. Well, let's put it this way. I know sometimes that I am provocative, and I don't run away from it. But I never could have been over 36 years. And the funny thing is, Ian, when I first signed on with NPR, I thought it was sort of a temporary few months gig, you know, that kind of thing. Huh. But when I do say something controversial one week, I try very hard the next week to pick a lighter subject. I don't want to be known as somebody who just simply rants and is always negative. That people would get tired of that. And that's, as a matter of fact, the way I wrote the book or selected the pieces in the book. I didn't put all the provocative pieces together or all the football pieces together. I mixed and matched. And that's what I try to do.
How did you get the gig with NPR in the first place?
It's really very funny because, of course, I wasn't there. But apparently they were having a meeting about starting Morning Edition. This would have been in the fall of 1979. And kind of at the end of the meeting, somebody suddenly piped up and said, you know, we ought to have some sports on, too. And it just hadn't occurred to anybody. And so they appointed the lowest person there on the totem pole. It was Ketzel Levine. Many people who heard NPR through the years know that she was the gardening expert for a long time. And they said, Ketzel, get us a couple of commentators. I don't know if they said it quite that directly. And she knew nothing about sports. And here she was with this assignment. She called up her father, who lived in Brooklyn, and he suggested Red Barber, who had called the Dodger games. And, of course, Red had many great years with NPR and Bob Edwards, so they often talked about azaleas and the opera more than they did sports. And then somebody suggested that there was a guy at Sports Illustrated who wasn't afraid to express an opinion, and maybe he could do some radio too. And she contacted me, and as I say, I thought, hey, this sounds like fun for a few months. And bingo, there I was, and have done it ever since. It's been a wonderful association because it gives me a chance to talk to a broad audience.
You've written in virtually every type of medium. How do you approach writing for radio? Does it differ from your other projects?
Well, it's different, but it's not. And by that I mean it's not exceptionally different. First of all, it's a question of time, and I have 3 minutes to do my commentaries on NPR, and so you can't clear your throat too many times. Whereas the long pieces that I've done, or goodness gracious, the books, you can wander and digress, and you can't do that. And I found out early on, you have to stick pretty much to the point. And sometimes that means throwing away material that I really think is good, but it just doesn't quite fit into that 3 minute piece that you have. It has to be pretty direct. By the same token, I do want to make sure that I get in a good turn of phrase here or there. I mean, if it was just me reading sort of statistics, it wouldn't be much fun. So when I did the book, though, I made sure that the commentaries that I chose, and it's about 100 of them, that I didn't change them. I didn't change them and make them more, shall we say, readable. I kept them exactly as they were, as I had delivered them on the radio. And so it's not that different. You just it's writing. It's writing in, and most of the time I'm writing for the eye. For NPR, I'm writing for the ear. And I just look at it that way.
Our guest is Frank DeFord, and he will be signing copies of his new book, I'd Know That Voice Anywhere, this Saturday at Sweet Pea in Stone Ridge. I want to get your thoughts on some current events in sports. And as we are speaking, we're heading into what could be the last game of the NBA Finals. The Warriors are leading the Cavs at this moment, and no team has come back in the finals from a 3-1 deficit before, which is what the Cavs are facing. So by the time this airs, we might know the answer to this. But in the meantime, what do you make of this Golden State Warriors team? They have won the most games ever in the regular season.
Well, they're fun to watch. I mean, that's the main thing. I did a piece for one of my commentaries earlier in the year in which I said everybody loved the San Antonio Spurs, because they're a team that, you know, plays well together and moves the ball around, and the Warriors have sort of taken the Spurs to a new level, and of course, in the midst of it all is Stephen Curry, who is absolutely remarkable. I'm showing my age when I say that he reminds me of Jerry West, who was a great player in the, you know, 1960s, but even Jerry, as fabulous as he was never capable of the kind of long range shooting that Curry is. I've never seen anybody get the ball away so fast, and if you could take a photograph of him every time he shot, he never seems to vary his position. He's amazingly disciplined. His muscle memory is extraordinary, and so I'm very fond of Golden State. I think they're a wonderful team. Now, having said that, I always feel a little sorry for Cleveland that they can't win anything. You know, going back to what, 1964?
Yeah, it's been a long time.
So my heart bleeds for Cleveland, but I think that from a spectator point of view, I kind of root for the Warriors.
And on the other side, there's LeBron James, of course, who came up. He's from Ohio, played with Cleveland, left for Miami, won his two titles, and is now back in Cleveland. They axed the coach halfway through the year. It's sort of his team. Do you think there's a lot riding on it, for LeBron's legacy?
Well, I've never agreed with people who measure great team athletes by the number of championships that they have. I mean, we went through that earlier in the year with when Peyton Manning took his team, the Broncos, to the Super Bowl. And everybody was, well, not everybody, a lot of people were saying, well, this will determine his legacy, you know, that sort of thing. And whether or not he won the game, he did win the game, though he didn't play very well. He was a great player over a career, and LeBron James is an extraordinary player. You can get into the argument whether he's better than Michael Jordan was or not, but he's if he's not number one, he's number two, okay? And whether or not he ever wins another championship, I mean, to me, he's establishes his greatness, and also I think he gets high marks for loyalty, for going back to Cleveland. I think, Ian, the only thing that marks against him is that you simply can't have a player, I don't care who he is and how good he is, who kind of makes the controlling decisions the way he seems to. And it doesn't work. He essentially got the coach fired and put somebody in there who he likes better. And it just upsets the natural order of things. A player can't run a team.
I want to also get you to weigh in on the Rio Olympics. Everything we read seems to be negative about this upcoming Olympics. What do you think?
I think everything about them is negative. The one thing that's not negative is that, which happens so often with the Olympics, nothing is ready until the last second. Well, somehow in Rio, they've gotten just about everything built, but I think everything else is dicey. And of course, the whole business with Zika is scary, and so is anybody who has to participate in the water there, not in the pool, but in the water, the long distance swimmers, the people who are in various boats where the water splashes up. I mean, it's garbage. I mean, you know, it's terrible. And then on top of all that, you have a terrible political situation. You have a terrible economic situation. And I think the people are rife for, you know, getting upset And I wouldn't be surprised if there were riots. So I think we have to keep our fingers crossed for these Olympics.
As to football, do you think we're at a tipping point here with reports about the brain damage the sport does? Will you feel any guilt going into the next season turning the game on opening weekend?
That's a good question. Do we, in effect, become enablers because we make football so popular? Football isn't going to go away. Football is too popular, and neither can I see them changing it much. And some people say, well, we just need better helmets. Well, helmets are not the issue. Helmets protect the skull. They don't protect the brain. And the charm of football, if you will, is how violent it is. That's what makes the sport what it is and what it always has been. And going back to the 19th century, it is a violent game, and there are always going to be people who will play it for big money, and there'll always be fans. Sometimes people compare it to boxing and say, well, look, boxing faded away. Yeah, but boxing is an individual sport. Football is a team sport with allegiances. What I would like to see is younger kids not playing football. That is what I couldn't do. I could not go out to a youth football game and watch young kids. I don't even think I could go to a high school game. So I don't think kids at that age have any business playing it. And you can't stop mature adults, but it's a mean game, and we know what kind of toll it can take. And I just hope that more and more youth leagues cut out the tackling, cut out the sport. I think that's gonna happen over the coming years too. I think we're gonna see fewer and fewer schools and maybe even small colleges dropping the sport.
You mentioned boxing, and I'll end by asking for your reflection on the death of Muhammad Ali.
Well, we knew how sick he'd been, and really nothing has changed in the last 20 years. There wasn't a great deal new to say about him. And I do feel, as I sort of suggested a few minutes ago, that boxing is dying with him, or died with him, or is in the process. It becomes, I think, harder and harder for boxing to sustain any popularity at all when it doesn't have these great historical characters still around, and now that Muhammad is gone, that's one more void. He was an extraordinary figure. There's no question about it. He was a complicated man, and at the end of the day, he was something of a tragic figure. Not something, that's not fair. He was a tragic figure, and I saw him a few times in those last few years, and it was painful to watch. It really was, and especially when he couldn't talk anymore. A guy who just loved to talk. I remember one time he and we were having dinner, six or seven of us in New York, and he couldn't participate in the conversation, and he literally fell asleep on my wife's shoulder. It's amazing. Careful, my wife left over, and there was Muhammad Ali with his head on her shoulder. he was lost, but he was brave.
Well, we've been speaking with the great Frank DeFord, the author of I Know That Voice Anywhere, my favorite NPR commentaries. And the occasion of our interview is that you'll be signing copies of it at Sweet Pea in Stone Ridge, New York, this Saturday. Frank DeFord, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope people know it's a Father's Day treat for me because my daughter runs the shop. My daughter Scarlett runs the shop there at the shopping center in Stone Ridge, Emmanuel, and so it's that's why I'm there for Father's Day. It's a good chance for me to be a father and for us to share Father's Day together.
Well, happy Father's Day, and we're excited to have you in the region.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.